Welcome, everybody. This is an episode of the Founder Series here at IMD. It's organized by the Alumni Center for Entrepreneurship here at IMD. And we try in this series to engage entrepreneurs who are related to the school. Some are, some aren't. Our guest today is actually an EMBA from a few years ago, which is great. It's nice to have alum back to the school for things like this, especially alum who've been out trying to break new ground and create new organizations. And that's what this is all about. The Founder Series is an attempt to help would-be founders who are interested in trying to understand what it's really like as opposed to what you read in the popular press, and also would-be investors who are trying to understand how they judge the people in front of them. We're often told that when you look at an investment, it's really the business person in front of you that you need to understand much more than the business plan that's sitting on the table. And these sessions are a little bit about trying to understand better what real-life entrepreneurs are like, other than the cartoon characters we sometimes see. So I'm Ian Stewart, an alum of the school from a long, long time ago, longer than I care to remember. And I've done a bunch of things which you could look up if you haven't already looked up already. And our guest today is Eike Festini, who is Austrian but started a company in Zurich. I'd like to know the reason for that at some point. And is here to talk about some of the challenges that happen when things don't quite go according to plan. Eike, welcome back to IMD.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Let's dive straight in. What I'd like to get a start on is how you got to Lookabox, right? We'll talk about Lookabox, the company, in a minute, but take us on a path through from Austria through to the various things that you did, and it's a fun list, to get to Lookabox.
Yeah, so I actually grew up in Austria and in South Africa, so I was used to being on the move from a very early age. And when I was 22, I actually moved to the United States, basically exploring my own identity, I guess. I lived in San Francisco. I worked as a holistic massage therapist during the day and was the manager of an oxygen and sushi bar during the night.
Very San Francisco.
It was an amazing time. And we moved to Cape Town after that, where I actually started being in IT project management for the first time. That's when I first got in touch with project management and technology development. After moving back to Vienna, I went into Agile, Scrum, product ownership, all of that. As an Agile evangelist, you could actually say. And that's when I was headhunted by a UK company to join a company in Zurich.
Ah, that's how you got to Zurich. Okay.
That's how I got to Zurich. And having lived in Vienna all in all for 17 years and having grown up in the Alps in Vorarlberg, I really, really miss the mountains. So that and the job offer, it was a very easy decision. So that's, for me, that was the first time in a corporate.
And I wanted to ask about that, because you said, I know that your family are actually entrepreneurs. Why did you end up in the corporate life? Why did you not think about automatically, oh, I must be an entrepreneur as well?
I really don't know. I somehow just dabbled into it, and then I played the game, I guess. And I played it really well. So I actually made quite a career for myself in the corporate world. I found it very easy to a certain degree. And it was... At home, it was always very difficult because nobody understood what I was actually doing, and nobody understood why I would actually sell my soul. You know, I know this is a drastic, but you know where I'm coming from. And I never really thought about it, and I had many fights with my sister even, because she would rather starve, you know, than having a boss. Seriously, like that serious. And I'm like, why don't you just go wait tables? She's like, no, I'm not gonna have a boss. So very, very strong, very strong-minded family about entrepreneurship. And it was during the corporate that I realized I'm lacking a lot of business foundation, fundamentals, strategy, etc. And that's actually what brought me to IMD.
It's interesting because a lot of people would do it the other way around. They'd start things on their own. If it didn't work, they'd use a business degree to make them appropriately equipped to survive in a large corporation. And you did the reverse. What exactly were you hoping to get from the MBA?
Interestingly enough, I think one of the very few people that went into the EMBA not wanting to become C-level. But I didn't know what I wanted out of it. It's just, I knew that that wasn't it. And it was during an excursion to the Silicon Valley where I actually realized, okay, this might be for me, this entrepreneurship topic. You know, when you know me, you know I'm not a corporate person. I'm very free-spirited and I speak my own mind. And I do raise issues without holding back. I'm not very conformative, let's put it that way. But I never knew. I always thought I was normal. So in the States and with Krano from IMD actually, it was when I really got bitten by the bug of opportunity, by the bug of courage, not looking back. Yeah, very much thinking in opportunities and in possibilities.
Is that why you went to Stanford afterwards? You did a course at Stanford straight after the MBA or soon after?
Design thinking, yes. Yeah. We actually did a course during the MBA as well, where I got really, really hooked on the topic. And I still, to this day, I love it. It's, for me, it's a very natural concept. You know, it's just so obvious, actually. I don't understand why this wasn't a concept from the get-go. So all of that, we came back to Europe and I knew I wanted to start a company.
How did you end up with the idea? Because wanting to start a company is one thing. I meet a lot of students, young, at different ages, who are keen to be entrepreneurs these days. But I think all they really want is to be independent, run their own thing and be rich. I'm not sure they understand what it's actually like.
Nothing wrong with that, though.
No, I'm perfectly happy with those as goals, but it's helpful to understand how you get from here to there. What was the first step? I often say to people, you need three things. You need a halfway decent idea, halfway decent. You need a team of people around you, because it's so hard to do it entirely on your own. And then you need to be able to have access to funding. If you have mm-hmm. those three things, that may be a good starting point. What was your starting point?
So the original idea was actually my co-founder's idea. She has a background in logistics. I really didn't. And now I'm an expert in supply chain, but I really wasn't. She had the idea and it wasn't even half decent. It was really nice, but the unit economics were really bad. So that part wasn't the best, but we had a good team. I had access to amazing tech talent from my previous position where I was leading an IT department. And together with them, we just started doing stuff, basically. And we started talking to everybody about it, reading about it, and just learning as much as we could as we went along. And we went into the startup scene right away. And we went to all kinds of competition much too early. There was so much rejection. It was really, really tough in the beginning. We're like, okay, so maybe I remember one of our devs saying, I don't understand why people don't want this. It's amazing, you know? I'm like, yeah, but it's not that easy. You know, it takes a little more. So it was actually, the first idea was really, really bad. We turned it around 180 degrees and then we realized, okay, now it's slowly picking up.
So the changing of the idea presumably came from talking to customers who said, no, not this way, that way.
No, it really came from all the rejections at the competitions first. And then we did a pilot, which ran really well. Everybody wanted the service. And we then did the unit economics after, you know, having done all the math. And we knew of a company in the United States that was flying with this model and got so much funding. We're like, okay, there must be something about it. But when we did the unit economic calculation, we knew that was never going to work. It was just never going to work. And that company in the US is also now at close down because the unit economics didn't work. That's an American phenomenon for me, you know, getting funding without a solid.
Right. It's much easier to raise money there. Yeah. I've worked in both China and the US, and it's much easier to raise money in environments where there's trillions of dollars floating around than it is where people hand out a million each very carefully. Do you want to describe just exactly what Lookabox did, or at least what the idea was at the beginning and then how it transformed?
Yeah, at the very, very beginning, we were thinking of servicing the first mile of the supply chain. For those that are not supply chain experts, we wanted to build an app that when you sell something on Tutti or Ricardo or eBay or whatever, and you make a lot of money, you basically just take a picture of that item. We come and pick it up, we package it, and we ship it for you. Because today, when you sell something, you're like, yay, that's a lot of money. But then you need to find an appointment or you need to package it. And I mean, package, you know, skis or whatever. So that was the original idea where the unit economics didn't work. We then really shifted to B2B and we focused on the last mile. And since I'm a super impatient person, we had this idea to ship within an hour in all kinds of urban areas. Basically what today, you know, is done by Gorillas or Flinks, you know, who do it basically, who push it to an extreme. But that was the idea, really have customized delivery windows. You basically get delivered what you want when you want it. That was the idea. And that actually brought us some traction in the beginning until Mike and I were in Mallorca at the time. And one of our sales reps actually talked to somebody from an e-scooter provider company. And that's when things were about to change.
From people who are wondering, one of the taglines we've been using for this particular talk was not all pivots work. And there are two aspects to this particular pivot. One was that the pivot itself had issues, but the second was, how and why you ended up pivoting. Tell us about that.
The first pivot that we did that I just described was a very healthy pivot, right? We realized the unit economics weren't working out and we went to work with very established companies with a model that was pretty sane and pretty safe and tested. And when the e-scooter market started to open up, I think all of us remember it was a craze. You know, it was madness everywhere. All cities were full of scooters. And why we thought it would work is basically our sales rep, and I agree to this day, he approached them. He said, guys, you need logistics. We have logistics providers that we can use to help you, you know, with collecting scooters, charging them and putting them into the street because they all have warehouses, etc. So originally we thought there's an amazing synergy between having our partners deliver parcels during the day and collecting, you know, using the same vehicles and the same equipment and amenities to basically do scooter management. And also at that time, we were basically setting the price for the work we were doing. So we were basically in a position of power because all the scooter providers didn't know how to go about the logistics, you know, didn't have the tech, etc. It was also new. So in the beginning, we were making a lot of money, and I really mean a lot of money. The growth we had there was crazy. Within 3 or 4 months, we were servicing 3 or 4 scooter provider companies in 3 countries, and then going up to more than 3,000 scooters moved a day. And we didn't think of it as a pivot. We thought of it as a cash cow that could basically keep us independent from investors. The idea I still think is very nice. I would have liked to stay a little more independent going forward, but it just really didn't work out. It was not for us to manage such a huge operation. We had so many drivers, so many vans, so many warehouses to rent. You know, all of a sudden we went from being a tech provider or in a matchmaking platform to a full-blown 3PL, third-party logistics provider. And we were not cut out for it, A. And B, the market got very bad very quickly because everybody wanted to play in that market. It was the fastest growing market of all times.
Yeah, so you had two challenges then. One was you went from digital platform where you had very little risk because the cash and the buyers and sellers were either side of you to actually running an operation, or you were running operations for clients, which meant you had physical exposure. The other thing you had at that point was a very heavy dependency because of the revenue stream and the investment you made in process to one sector. And that sector went up and went down almost as fast.
The downfall was way faster than our rise. We were raising our seed round in the course of the awakening of the e-scooter market. And we had a very attractive value proposition and a very attractive position in that market already for investors. And of course, also we could show a lot of traction. So it was a very impressive investment case at that moment. And that's also why it wasn't hard to raise money. So we raised quite a bit of money, which was burned super fast.
How much, just to give an order of magnitude?
I think it was 1.4 million. And we burnt it in 6 months or something.
Spent on what? What was it invested in?
Warehouses, drivers, vans, all the operation.
So operating costs, not so much CapEx, but just operating costs.
We were building an app as well, but we were too slow. Things were just too crazy. Well, what was really crazy about that time was e-scooters do not sleep, right? So our operations did not sleep. So we were basically working around the clock Monday to Sunday, and had most of the issues were during the night. So all of us very quickly, very tired, very, very tired. And the speed at which the e-scooter providers grew and we had to grow alongside with them was just insane.
How did it start to unravel?
Actually, by the time that more and more competitors came onto the market and offered the service, or probably better because more experienced service for much less money, we were losing turf. I mean, it was a war for territory for the e-scooter providers as well as it was for us. I mean, those that, you know, conquer Berlin were the heroes, you know, and then next would be Hamburg and then Munich, you know. So if you lose one of the cities, it's going to hurt you really bad. And we were losing turf and turf and turf, and not over months, over days. So at some point we had to really be very honest with ourselves and looked at how much money we were bleeding every day and had to pull the plug.
But you pulled the plug on that sector rather than the company first. What was the order of things? Was it so dominant that it actually created the downfall for the whole company at that point? Or was it a decision to move back and try and get out of e-scooters and try and go back to other sectors so you weren't so dependent upon one space?
The plan was to really create a holding and a separate entity for the scooter business. It had its own branding and everything, to not hurt Lookabox, because Lookabox was still existing. It didn't get a lot of love and it didn't grow necessarily, but we were still having a few B2B customers that were very happy with the service. But we never got to that point. Things were happening so fast that we could never split the two entities. So Lookabox was hurt really, really badly. By the time we pulled the plug, we also had to let go, you know, of, I don't know, 30 people or something, also overnight, basically. We had a few people left, basically the original core team, and we're out of money as well.
When was this? What year are we talking
about?
That's
June 2019.
Again, to recap, moving into a space that seemed attractive, spilled out of just doing e-platform into physical logistics at the same time, dependency therefore on a single marketplace, yeah, in something which was heavily hyped and therefore very quickly heavily competitive. Mm-hmm. Competitors came in both for the e-scooter clients that you had, but also mm-hmm. then logistics providers for those clients. That created cash crunch, falling revenues, same costs, and you ended up in a cash flow crunch that eventually meant you had to let everybody go.
Yeah, plus we lost all trust of investors.
Yeah.
It was a very hard awakening. Some investors had just invested into the seed round probably a month before we pulled the plug. And I got calls like, Aki, you knew this was going to happen. Did you lie to us? Were you dishonest? You know, did you hide something in the due diligence? It was very tough. So we were basically out of money. We had hardly any people. We had a few customers left. And it was basically a down round, a very, very serious down round. So we found a few investors, angels primarily, that said, you know what? I believe in you. And there are still a few customers that are very happy with the product. So I'll help you. And we did raise a small round. And I don't know even where to start with how much we learned, but we were so rattled at that point. And it was all about survival after it was about surviving the e-scooter madness, you know, so it's still survival mode, but we didn't want to let go. Let's just put it that. It wasn't time for me to give up. And we raised a small round. We focused on the original, like the second idea of, you know, the B2B last mile provider, matchmaking platform as well, and started to really gain traction. But the company, the image, every team member was heavily bruised. We weren't the same anymore. We weren't as blue-eyed and as naive as we were before. It was a serious wake-up call. We were super, super careful with money, all of a sudden very cost-conscious, which I have to admit we weren't that much before. So for us as the core team, it was a super, super intense maturity journey, I would say. And actually we grew up, let's put it that way. We grew up. It was almost like we went through puberty, just that we lost millions, you know, in the process. So a very, very expensive learning money. But it was then a few months later when COVID hit. And COVID was a huge blessing for us because all of a sudden everybody wanted home deliveries and they wanted them, you know, fast and convenient because they don't want to leave the house. And that's when actually that model of Lookabox really, really started taking off. And we extended the team. We had a very strong chief product owner who had a very strong vision for the product. Amazing clients like IKEA, you know, Migros, big, big names. And it was just fun. It was really, at that point, it was amazing. And I loved it. Not my co-founder, not so much. My co-founder never recovered from the e-scooter madness. And I think that for me was very interesting to observe because she didn't have the energy to start again. She's like, okay, because then, of course, now that we were gaining traction, the pressure was on. And this time for real, because, okay, this is your turnaround chance and you probably have one, right? Then now all of a sudden we have the pressure to not die, but to really blossom, you know, and to thrive now. So she went into a burnout and left the company, which made it very hard for me. Being the solo founder, not just in terms of image, but emotionally doing this alone is just, and I mean, who's going to replace a co-founder? It's very difficult.
It is tough, yeah. She was the co-founder with the background in logistics to begin with.
Yes.
So her idea. And by then you've learned a great deal. So you have the capacity, theoretically, yeah, to do all the things you're doing. But yeah, what you're describing is, in a sense, a loss of personal momentum amongst the team, which, yeah, just makes it hard to keep going. So what happened?
Yeah. So what happened at that point, we basically, that bridge money that we raised was running out again and we had to raise. And this time we knew it would be a Series A round. So we were looking at 4 to 5 million. We have the traction. We had the customers. We had the team. But we had a very complex, let's call it broken even, cap table. The down round hurt my co-founder and myself very much. And we never put enough, I think, focus and energy on really cleaning it up and maybe providing the company a chance to survive by actually providing enough equity for the co-founders to be credibly incentivized.
I might jump in there and say, to explain to people who aren't aware, so the cap table is your list of investors, how much they own of the company, how much they've put in. When a new investor comes in, it's one of the first things we look at to make sure that we understand that there are incentives aligned, first of all, that everybody's aligned in their incentives. So we don't like to see, if you're an early stage investor, you don't like to see different categories of share or debt, which misaligns people's incentives for supporting the company as it goes forward. The other thing which you're referring to is that it's terribly important that the investors see enough motivating incentive for the founders. Because if there isn't A, skin in the game so that they're committed to it, and B, a possible return, there's a chance that when things get tough, people just leave. So that's what you're referring to when you talk about getting cleaning up the cap table and making sure it's in a state that new money can come in with confidence, knowing that the people who are there will stay and will help build the company.
Exactly. That was one of the biggest issues. The feedback we got from investors was, okay, so A, your co-founder left. B, you hardly have any equity left. Why would I believe that you're still in this company in 1 year from today? It's only now that I actually, or at that time, that I realized how big of an issue a down round can become later on. And maybe should we also explain what a down round is?
Because sure. So a down round is when you take an investment in from new investors at a pre-money price that is lower than your previous round. So in other words, what everybody wants to see is rising prices with each successive investment round, which is why you go angel, series A, series B, and so on. If you have to take a down round, it makes it very clear that there was a problem, a serious problem in the company. And that tells new investors who see that in the history of the cap table, that there were problems that may or may not have been resolved by that point. It's a negative signal for investors. It's obviously negative for anybody who suffered dilution, in this case, the two founders. But it also signals that there might be deeper problems. It means that it did not go to plan.
Yeah, I mean, show me the startup that goes to plan. But anyway, so at that time, I think we were raising for a very, very long time. We found a potential lead investor, a very prestigious VC fund in Switzerland, which was a very good signal, again, you know, to the market, to the investors. But then it took too long. I couldn't find appropriate co-investors. And yeah, it was dragging on too long. Even though at that point we made as much revenue as we did with the e-scooters. So revenue grew really, really fast. The whole commercial side of the business, the tech, the product, the team was a joy. We were really taking off and we all knew it. We had the momentum, but I just couldn't close the investment round. Yeah. Now we're talking September, October, November 21. So yeah, it's actually since COVID started. To that point, we grew at least 15 to 20% a month. It was really nice growth. Yeah, it was very solid. It was, you know, established partnerships with established companies, not like the Wild West with the e-scooter providers. It was amazing. I loved it. It was really, really good. And I think it was November when he called and he said, I love what you're doing and I'm a big fan of you, but I'm losing credibility by sticking to this, by basically sticking my neck out here. And you're not able to win co-investors. So I'm pulling back my offer. And at that point, I mean, that was a really serious blow. We were out of money. At that point, again, I mean, every time we ran out of money, I fired people. And very openly always, I said, listen, I might raise the money. I would love to hire you back. But for now, I just need to fire you or need, you know, terminate the contract. So we were already scaling down again, which hurt operations. But we did have a plan B, which we had actually from the very, very start. It was a company that had very big synergies with us and needed a platform like Lookabox for their own operations. We always knew Lookabox could be white label used and we were looking for exit potential everywhere. So basically, this was a big company that shipped furniture and parts of building material from A to B, and they wanted to do it super, super precise, you know, just in time delivery. So they then jumped in the beginning with a very generous offer until, of course, we went on with the due diligence and they looked at the books and the state of the company at that time. And they knew if they just waited a little bit longer, the price would drop significantly. which of course it did. So 2 months later, basically, we knew we were out of money. And then they said, okay, we're going to buy you. We had a big general assembly, and there was some upside down the line in the deal if I stayed on with them, and also the chief product owner, to actually integrate our software into their organization and, you know, make sure it runs. And then after 1 or 2 years, there would be some upside to the investors, which of course is a deal that I would have signed. You know, I probably wouldn't have seen anything as the founder. So I would have signed. Every investor agreed to the sale. And I think it was a week later, another corona wave hit. And it was a week later, they called us and they said, listen, we're running into liquidity issues ourselves due to corona. We need to pull out. So by then, I can't tell you how tired I was and how, you know, just drained I was at that point. I just knew that's it. That's the fatal bullet. And we had a few board meetings and we agreed that it's time to really close this before we create any damage on the operation side, on the customer side. So we downsized or we closed all operations, let everybody go to a complete full stop. And then we went to the bankruptcy office.
It's always tough.
Yeah.
I've been through that. It's a difficult thing to do. So we're now going to start talking a little bit more about what happens next, but also we'll start with a few questions about what might have been done differently, just in case there were things that Aika has in her mind about what she went through that might be learning sessions for people. So when people are busy, companies generally, when they're small, I recommend that they handle their own, partly because no one trusts any intermediaries as investors, and you always want to see the founding team themselves. But when you're very busy and you're in scale-up mode, then sometimes it makes sense, especially if the amounts being raised are larger, to have other people helping you go through the process, book meetings, run processes, create a stream of processes that help you get through to your fundraising round. So the question there for Aika was, were you using anybody through this process, any third parties to help with fundraising as you went through both the down round and then out through the what sounded like a really promising restart?
I actually did not take on any help. For me, it was important to do it myself because I also think it's a very different ballgame if you do it as a founder, especially if you're young and in an early stage company. For the last round, I did actually work with an agency that helped with introductions.
Right.
And they did an amazing job. It was very well done. They do it in your tone of voice. Basically, they act as if you're you so that it's not an intermediary. This got us a lot of meetings. That was very, very good. But usually I did it all myself. I think investor relations also by the end of Lookabox was probably 60% of my job.
Right. Yep. And actually, it's often 50% of the job for any CEO in any fast-growing organization, because you're constantly fundraising. It's one of the maddening things about it. You can't focus on the business because you constantly have to make sure there's cash there to help growth.
Yeah.
So if you look back now, leaving aside the emotions that come with it, and it may be too soon, is there anything you think you could have done differently to either deal with the craziness, as you called it, of the e-scooter company, or to rework or reinvigorate management for that second upcycle?
When we started with the e-scooter companies, there was an energy of stress, and I don't want to call it incompetence, but it was something felt off from the very beginning. And we had discussions that I don't think you should have between respectful business partners. And looking back, I should have said no, I think after 1 month of doing